Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin is going to take your calls. That's coming up here in just a bit. Also, will Seattle officially recognize chosen families, not just biological or the so-called nuclear family, but, for example, paid sick leave to care for someone who you've chosen to be family for you? All that coming up on KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you along today. It's going to be a busy weekend here in Seattle. You might be planning to head to a Juneteenth march and celebration, or a Father's Day barbecue, or maybe on Sunday night, you'll find yourself at St. Mark's Cathedral on Capitol Hill, where labyrinths are being set up to celebrate the summer solstice, which works out well. The Fremont Solstice Parade and Naked Bike Ride have been canceled this year, but what do labyrinths have to do with the longest day of the year? Here to explain is Beth Amsbury from the organizing group Gathering Ground. Hiya, Beth.
Hey, Bill, thanks for having us on.
Great to have you. What do these labyrinths look like at St. Mark's?
Oh, that's a great question. Imagine, if you will, you're walking along and you come up on this big kind of spiral on the ground. And it's wide enough that you could walk on it pretty readily. But as you look at it, you see it's got a big open space in the middle. And then the spiral twists and turns. And it doesn't just go straightforwardly in. So if you start walking it, sometimes you're really close to that middle circle. Sometimes you're way out on the edge. But there's no dead end. If you just keep putting one foot ahead of the next, you'll end up in the middle. And then you'll be thinking, well, that was weird, or that was fun, or my brain was really frustrated about that. And then you put one foot ahead of the next, and you walk back out. So sometimes they're put into the ground in beautiful stone pavers or carved into the ground. You might find one in sand on the beach or laid out onto ground with ribbon. Some people put them on a canvas so you can roll them up and take them wherever you want to go. And we'll have several of those sorts up there on Sunday.
And Beth, what does the labyrinth have to do with the summer solstice?
That's a great question. Labyrinths have been shown all over the world in many, many cultures, going back to antiquities. And who really knows what was happening 4,000 years ago when some of these were put in? But some of them are oriented towards where the sun rises or sets on the solstice. Very often they're oriented towards north, south, east, and west. For me, part of what I think about is it's the moment when the sun is making a turn in its circuit around, or where the earth is making its circuit around the sun. And here we are making this turn, just like on the labyrinth. You're making a turn and walking around. So it's a way to reflect on what's happening in the earth and with the change of light, and a way to center and to sort of reflect on all of these cycles of life in the world.
I know it's very different, but I'm picturing Stonehenge as you're talking. Is there any connection?
I think these are sometimes considered like astronomical markers and geometry. So I think that would be in common, but certainly it's not as detailed as a Stonehenge would be, but probably it was some sort of a marker of the year. And they certainly knew where the sun was rising and setting. In a place like Seattle, where the change of light, we're going to have 16 hours of light on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And in the winter, we'll have 16 hours of dark. So it's a marked difference between where the sun rises and sets.
And Beth, what hooked you? Why did you begin this solstice labyrinth project? What does it mean to you?
Well, it started out for me when my then boyfriend and now husband started to get together. I'm a person who likes doing a lot of spiritual practices that helps me keep my brain and heart together. And he calls himself a non-believer. And so we knew that we had a lot in common, but we just thought, are we going to be able to find any common ground between these differences? And he suggested that we start celebrating the Earth holidays, because it's something that everybody has in common, no matter what your belief system is. So it's a science-based story. It's a story you experience in the world around you. And then it's also a nice moment to pause and reflect. So as we started to do these together, our like friends and neighbors started to say, hey, can we join you for that? And so it started to become this thing that, you know, we'd be doing multiple events. And then when I started to get involved with Gathering Ground, we just immediately said, oh, Labyrinths are wonderful and Earth Holidays are good. And so we just started to say, let's do an outdoor labyrinth walk around the solstice in the summer. It's a great time to be outside and be in community. And a fun way to center that is apart from any kind of dogma or belief system.
An Earth Holiday celebrated spiritually at St. Mark's Cathedral. It sounds a little pagan, though.
Call it what you will. Some people are there for the engineering, and some people love the kind of pagan, crazy earth thing. A lot of labyrinths are in cathedral spaces, like Chartres in Paris. Hmm. So bring what you will, and just come and walk it and have fun.
Actually, that phrase you just said, bring what you will, is kind of what your group Gathering Ground is about. Will you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. We wanted to create a space where people of many beliefs could come together and make meaning in their own ways and also share with each other how they share and forge meaning. So our little moniker is Do Stuff, Reflect, and Connect. So no matter what your belief system is, from writing or looking at the solstice or doing some crafting together and thinking about, wait a minute, a mobile, how does it balance? Where is my balance? How do I construct balance? Oh, interesting to hear your story about balance. Oh, let's share this. So by doing and reflecting together, we create meaning for people of many perspectives, which seems so appropriate in the world today, right? Because people are coming from so many different perspectives.
It sounds like it could be the kind of communion that people like, but a lot of folks have moved away from organized religious gatherings.
Absolutely. I think dogma is sort of a thing that many people are no longer interested in, but they still want community and they still want places to do meaning making. So this is one of those experiments, like a lot of places in the U.S. and around the world are experimenting with what does meaning making look like these days?
Yeah, I think that's especially true in Seattle. Finally, Beth, for anyone who wants to go, tell us again, when and where is this solstice event?
Absolutely. It's 7 to 9 p.m. this Sunday, the 20th, at St. Mark's Cathedral. The address up there is 1245 10th Avenue East. We do ask that people RSVP because we're trying to find that balance between community and safety and permission. So you can RSVP on our website, gatheringground.org, and there's just one G in the middle of gatheringground.org.
Yeah, what are masks and social distancing going to be in the labyrinth?
Absolutely. We are do ask folks to bring a mask and to plan to social distance. We're going to have a host at each labyrinth inviting just one household to walk each labyrinth at a time. And if you have to wait, we're going to have activity tables with drawing, and we're going to have chalk so that you can draw chalk labyrinths. And it's a nice place to watch the sunset. So there'll be a lot of chances to be in community and also choose your level of safety and distance.
Beth, enjoy the coming light, enjoy the spirituality and the mathematics, and enjoy the coming darkness, too. It's all a piece. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Beth Amsbury, a convener at Gathering Ground, on the record on KUOW. Coming up, the question of officially recognizing our chosen families. Stay tuned. This is The Record on KUOW. Good to have you along. The way we define families has always changed. It's gone beyond the so-called nuclear family to include step-parents, foster children, three-parent adoption, also caregivers, drag mothers, play cousins, and friends. We sometimes call these our chosen family. My next guest is trying to get the city of Seattle and the state of Washington to officially recognize chosen families. Attorney Melissa Hall is at Small Law. Welcome, Melissa.
Hello.
What does government recognition of chosen families mean?
Well, right now it costs somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000 to get some of the rights of a family member. And those documents are somewhat fragile. You have to have them with you, and they don't really give you the dignity that someone who happens to have a family member that acts in their interest has.
This might be paid sick leave, for example, a funeral, rights.
Paid sick leave, funerals, the ability to object to certain actions like custodianships. I can't give that to people who are not consanguineous family, which means that they're related by blood or marriage in the ways that the law likes to recognize. I can, you know, give somebody some decision-making powers, but fundamentally, we don't have a way to make somebody family that's recognized by the law in our current system.
Also,
except
with
marriage.
Except marriage, yes. Also with us is community advocate and activist Sarah Majid. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you here, Sarah. How have limits on chosen family recognition affected you?
Yeah, so actually we have a current situation at my house. My wife is applying for parentage for the fourth time in her child's life, who is now 9 and a half, and has been there with her, you know, since the womb, postpartum, all of that. And yet Washington state law, despite revisions of parentage paperwork in 2019, still do not accept non-biological mothers as legally recognized.
And I'll ask Melissa and then you, Sarah, about this legislation I said a little bit about. Is that right, Melissa, that you're pushing for this at city level and state of Washington? And would you describe what the a little more about what the legislation would say and how it's different from what kind of recognition we have now?
Okay, right now you don't get an opportunity to change who your family is very much. You have adoption and you have marriage. What we're looking for is an opportunity for people to go into the court and get a court order that makes them family. That would have some effects on the city, but it would probably largely be symbolic. However, the state level is where we do most of our family recognition, and it could have profound effects on basically our entire legal system if we were able to have people that we choose recognized as family.
Why only symbolic in Seattle? What's the situation in Seattle currently?
Right now, basically, deciding who your family is a matter of state law in most cases. The exceptions that could be made would be for city services, because the state, when they have a law, trumps the city.
Sarah, what would legislation like this on the state level mean for you?
Yeah, I think it would mean the absolute world. You know, my wife's daughter, she knows who her mom is. And so to have some people in the government tell her that's not true is completely devastating. And, you know, in addition, I advocate a lot for chosen family, specifically for folks who are LGBTQI that have ever in their life identified as Muslim here in Seattle. And, you know, there's a lot of kinship. There's, as you said, like play cousins and, you know, folks I consider my aunt and my uncle. And without my biological family currently in my life, it would, you know, if ever an emergency happened or something like that, like who would be able to come to the emergency room besides my wife, you know? So it would definitely mean the world if it was possible.
You know, this idea, chosen family, it's a very important aspect of queer community. That's the typical pop cultural reference, but they extend to all kinds of families and situations. Would each of you say a little more about what the best way is to understand chosen families, Melissa?
Well, the first time I started thinking of chosen family, I was 10 or 12 when I found out someone I had always considered family wasn't considered our family under the rules that applied legally. That was one of my grandparents' neighbors. She was at all of our celebrations, and it never occurred to me that she was anything but family. When she passed, it was really kind of a shock to discover that, no, there were these other people that I had never met that were in charge of what happened to her. Since then, you know, getting involved with the queer community, I now have a practice that's mostly involved with trying to recognize chosen family and what I call kind of improve the hands of people who didn't get a great first selection of family. Uh-huh. But my ability to do it is limited.
Sara, what do you want to say about the how we should understand the idea of chosen family?
Yeah, I mean, similar to Melissa, you know, chosen family is somewhere you feel at home. It's the people, you know, you can go to with the good or the bad, and, you know, they give you advice or they comfort you. There's no judgment. You know, there's full acceptance. You can bring your whole self. It's, like I said, it feels like home. So it's somewhere you walk in where you can just set your load down and, you know, feel like yourself most of all.
Melissa mentioned, I think it was a grandparent's neighbor. Sara, what was your first experience where you were conscious of the idea of what chosen family means to you?
Yeah, this is, you know, this is really crazy and really amazing at the same time. So I'm a child of immigrants, and when they first migrated, they migrated to California, and they didn't know a single person here. They just knew, you know, they wanted to have better opportunities. And someone from, you know, their uncle's neighbor was like, I also know somebody in California. Here's their phone number. And back in the day, in the 70s and the 80s, that's how folks found each other. And that family I'm still very close with. They're, you know, it's basically my aunt. We have no biological family in the United States. So, yeah, that was my first experience, and it's been the same since. As folks migrate here, you know, we get people's phone numbers, they get ours, and it's holidays together every other weekend, you know, barbecues. It's, yeah, it's amazing.
By the way, I should say again who I'm speaking with, that's Sara Majid, who's a community activist and an advocate, and we're talking with attorney Melissa Hall at Small Law, and we're talking about official recognition of chosen families. I don't know that the two of you know each other or know each other well. Do you compare notes on your similar and different takes on where we stand with chosen families and what it means? I was
sort of
curious how the two of you, the two of you talking to one another.
Yeah, it's interesting because we came at this from very different situations. I deal with people who are trying to get specific recognition, whereas Sara does more to create that kind of family experience for people. And they're both so powerful.
Yeah, you know, we really, as a community, look to people like Melissa who, you know, are educated and aware about policy and lawmaking. And without the other, I don't think any of this would be possible. It sounds like we both have a shared vision. And from the moments we've spoken, there's a lot of power there to be pushed.
You know, I've seen some legal language, like President Obama gave paid sick leave to federal contractors to care for people who are, this was the quote, the equivalent of a family relationship. And I wondered what that means. Does that mean that a chosen family must go somehow beyond friendship? What makes something the equivalent of a family relationship? Either of you have a thought on that?
Well, for my law firm, the way that I describe family for people, because I have a tier that takes care of people's families, is it's the people that you drop everything and go to the ER for.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's the thing. Even when you get to the ER, what can you do? That's where we kind of run into the catch-22, you know.
We've
had some emergencies in our family recently, hospital emergencies, and tried to get paid sick leave, family, FMLA, I mean, and it's not been possible. They basically said if it's, you know, it's up to the organization still to employ it the way that they choose, despite the law allowing, as you said, what President Obama signified as such. And it's not necessarily, that right is not necessarily given. At least it wasn't given to me.
I have, yeah, go on, Melissa.
Oh, no, I'm just, it's very, I have never heard of anybody getting FMLA leave for somebody that they can't prove is a family member by marriage, adoption, or shared blood relationships.
Yes, well, exactly.
Sometimes I hear, whenever we talk about extending an entitlement or extending benefits, I hear some kind of backlash along the lines of, are there no limits? Sort of like the whatever it is going to be extended to whatever you say it is, and it's going to be taken advantage of. What do you say to that?
I think this is the age-old. Oh, go ahead, Melissa.
Oh. Okay. There's basically two things. First of all, I hear people who have immigration concerns, and adult adoption already doesn't establish immigration rights, so that's kind of already off the table.
You mean this is the idea that somebody could say that someone who's undocumented is my family, is that family relationship, and give them rights that they wouldn't otherwise have?
Yeah, that's the one that I most often hear.
Mm-hmm.
And like that is already not possible with adult adoption, so there's no reason to think that that would be different for an adult chosen family relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that I like to say to this is it's very strange that in a country that so values liberty, we don't give mm-hmm. people the right to choose who family is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with that. You know, it kind of goes back to the age old thing of like the welfare queen, you know, giving folks liberties with the best intentions is, you know, not always going to birth malice. You know, it's just not believing in your citizens is just not a solution focused government. It's a criminalizing government. It's a systemic, essentially a systemic way of punishment as opposed to anything. It's a limit.
Yeah, it would be great if like somehow everybody could have a good life if they complied exactly with the defaults that set up. But that's not a realistic way to govern a government that values liberty or individual choice.
What is this power that families have? Because you could think of chosen family, that is a more powerful choice and meaning. There's an intentionality there.
Mm-hmm. Well, to speak to it from the legal perspective, when we're going to family, when we're looking for next of kin, we are looking for the person who we feel is best able to speak for you. And that sometimes is a very good choice. But often in the case of people who are estranged from their families of origin, it can result in terrible effects.
Yeah, I again, Melissa, your points are so great. I totally agree with that. You know, in this nation, we have a huge problem with trans people being disproportionately murdered. And when they pass away, if they are estranged from their family, as Melissa said, you know, is the media using the right pronouns? Are they really getting the justice that they deserve? Is their community able to show up for them and, you know, identify the body? Like, there's so many things that go into that. It's a complete injustice that that chosen families are not recognized, especially with what the nation is seeing.
Well, finally,
and I think there's something really. Oh, no, please.
Well, I'm aware that we're about to talk to the mayor here. We're ending our time together,
yeah.
And I wanted to ask each of you, for anybody looking, how do you find chosen family? Sarah, do you want to start that?
Yeah, so chosen family, you really start finding by deciding that's what you deserve. You know, you deserve somewhere to to feel fully accepted and to feel like you have someone to call and be next to. And so in order to do that, I, back in 2013, started a Facebook group, which was a support group and just a gathering group for, as I mentioned earlier, for anyone who's ever identified as Muslim, that's also on the LGBTQI spectrum. And I just started talking to people, telling them, you know, what we could have. And now it's flourished into over 55 people who want the same exact thing. So, yeah, Chosen Family is there for you when you're ready to find it.
Melissa, what do you want to say about how we find our chosen family?
I think this is really the power of deciding that family is something you do instead of something that you are. Once you decide that family is something that you can make, anywhere your heart hole, you will look around and find people who can be your family.
Melissa Hall is an attorney at Small Law, working on getting official recognition at the state level of what we're talking about today, chosen families. And Sarah Majid is a community advocate and activist. And I want to thank both of you for telling us about your work today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Bill. Thank you, Melissa.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW, and in just a moment, we are going to take your calls with the mayor of Seattle. In fact, I'll give you the phone number right now. You can hop on the phone and ask a question for Mayor Jenny Durkan. The number is 206-543-KUOW, 543-5869, and we'll be right back with that. The Record on KUOW Seattle. It is time to talk to the mayor of this town, Jenny Durkan, and take your phone calls. The mayor will let you ask a question, tell you what you want to know when you call 206-543-KUOW right now. Again, the phone is ready to go. It's 543-5869. Mayor Jenny Durkan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Bill, great to be here. And there is no better town than on these sunny days.
Yeah, we were just talking about solstice coming up, and we're just getting flooded with the rays. Mayor Durkan, before we get to some calls, we were just talking about a possible legislation at the city and even state of Washington level that would have recognizing officially give government recognition in different ways to so-called chosen family. For example, New York, L.A., Chicago now let workers use sick days to care, paid sick days to care for anyone who is like family to them. The equivalent of family is some of the legal language. I wanted to know what you think of that.
You know, I think it's a really important idea and one that's a long time in coming. We've seen the evolution over years. And Bill, you know, when my partner and I first had our kids, my adoption of our children wasn't recognized in almost every state. We had to carry paperwork with us everywhere we go so that if anything happened, there would be ability for me to even see them in the hospital. And if you look at what family is to people and what matters in their life, we really want people to have that kind of protection.
By the way, Mayor, the U.S. Supreme Court just this morning just ruled that the city of Philadelphia has to keep working with Catholic Social Services, even though that group will not certify foster parents who are in same-sex relationships. Do you think that has an effect on Seattle, that ruling?
You know, I have to look at the ruling. I will say it's super disappointing. I can't believe we're in 2021, and there's still a group of people that it's lawful to discriminate against. I think that the Catholic Church should be focused on what their mission is, which is taking care of children and not asking about, you know, whether the parents happen to be gay or not. We saw that in our own region where Catholic schools have fired people because they were gay. It's wrong. It's antiquated. It's bad for families. And I haven't read the court ruling, but it's disappointing we're still having those conversations.
Well, does Seattle contract with or refuse to contract with groups that discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation in a way that might be affected?
We'll have to look at that. You know, we have very strict rules in place about having everyone be open to, non-discrimination policies. We don't deal very much in the city with the adoption process itself. But, of course, we're going to look at that and look at what the Supreme Court ruling is. But I want to emphasize that our city is a place that led the way in many ways on LGBTQ rights. and we will continue to fight for those rights.
This is the mayor of Seattle. Jenny Durkin is taking your questions as well. Our phone number is area code 206-543-KUOW. The numbers there are 543-5869. Let's talk about the city of Seattle then, Mayor. The city's eviction moratorium is scheduled to expire in 2 weeks. City Council officially called on you to extend that through the end of the year. Will you do that?
So even before they called on me to extend it, I've told people that we're in the conversations with the governor, and I wanted to see if there could be a statewide moratorium, but have said very clearly that I did not believe it was time for evictions to go forward. So, again, we'll be acting, but we're hoping to act in tandem with the governor.
It's 2 weeks away, this expiration. Is that going to happen at either
yes,
state or city level?
Yes, it will happen before the expiration.
Okay. Through the end of the year, do you know?
You know, I have to look at the time frame. The thing we're most focused on is, first, you know, there are tens of millions of dollars now coming from federal, state, and local resources for rent relief. But we haven't had the systems in place to make sure that those dollars get to the landlords and get to the tenants. So we want to have a process in place that we can actually start getting that rent relief into people. And that hopefully will be the best bulwark against not just evictions, but the accumulation of debt, and also the ability for landlords to pay, you know, their own mortgages and property taxes and the like.
This is Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin. Again, our phone number 206-543-KUOW. And we have our first call. Christian is on the line with us. And Christian, what would you like to know from Mayor Durkin?
There are companies like flyhomes.com that buy houses for cash, don't pay real estate taxes for whatever they have set up with the state of Washington. And then ultimately, the Washington residents pay more for a house because now there's a middleman. Is there any plans for the city of Seattle to restrict these kinds of Wall Street invested buyers, kind of like you've restricted the Airbnb?
You know, that is a really good question and not one I'd heard before. Let me look into that and we'll come back to the listeners. As far as I know, there's no exemption from the real estate excise tax for out-of-state investment companies. But if there's a loophole that needs to be closed at the state level, I'll be fighting for it.
Okay. Kristen, thank you for the question. You just put something on the mayor's agenda, home flipping. So, okay, we'll hear more about that. Mayor Durkin, you were saying something about the glorious sunshine in Seattle. Unfortunately, we got to talk smoke as well. It's been hot and dry in the Northwest and summer's coming. Can you guarantee that the city's going to have enough smoke shelters this time around should we need those?
So as you know, a few years ago when we had the big smoke events, we started opening smoke shelters. We're very worried about a smoke season. We've already seen record highs on the West Coast right now, which increases the fire for danger. We will not have enough places for everyone in Seattle to come inside. And so we're really working to figure out how do we make sure that those places we have, we get people to them, get them safely. We have, unfortunately, had to do this over the past two summers. So we will continue to put an emphasis on having those places available and then getting people the information they need to get somewhere safe.
This summer smoke, Mayor, as you know, has become almost a new normal. Why is there still not enough places to bring people inside if there's a health hazard?
So it's a new normal, but it's for a very short period of time. We retrofitted some of our community centers with the kind of HVAC you need to really keep people safe and want to make sure we bring the most vulnerable inside. We also have been working with entities to make sure that everyone themselves are thinking about what does their own airflow systems look like, because it's the smoke danger is not just for people who are living outside, but it can be for people who are inside in nursing homes, in apartment buildings that don't have adequate ventilation. So we're going to have to be really, you know, double down on getting education to people on what people need to do, regardless of whether their house status is.
So it can be an acute health need. As you say, it happens for a short time, relatively short time during the summer. So are you saying there's just never going, the city's never going to make provision to bring everybody who's in harm's way from the smoke in during the summertime?
I'm not sure what you mean, everybody who's in harm's way. Anybody who's traveling outside at all or anybody who has a reason to go outside during those periods of times is at risk and has to take extra precautions. And so the city will try to make sure that we're working on every level. And not just in the city, but obviously it's a region-wide and statewide issue as well. So working with the state and the county and the city to make sure that we have adequate information for people to stay safe.
Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin wants to know what you want to know. Our phone number again, 206-543-KUOW. That's 5869. Scott is on the line. Scott, what would you like to know from Mayor Durkin?
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Mayor Durkin. I'm just trying to follow up and figure out when the Seattle Neighborhood Service Centers are going to reopen. I have a son who we want to renew his passport, but can't get that done until they reopen.
I don't have the answer for that right now. The passport renewal system was also changed, not just by the fact that our neighborhood service centers were closed, but the State Department, because of the pandemic, was taking only certain kinds of renewals, as I understand it. But we hope to get those open. It's soon. It's another thing I'll have to come back to you, but the whole reopening right now has been predicated on what is the governor and the state going to do. And we've been limited about how many people we can have gather, what kind of businesses we can do, bringing people back. And so as soon as the governor announces and we have the ability to reopen, we're going to get those open as soon as we can.
Thanks for the question, Scott. Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin taking your phone call. And let's go to Lewis. Lewis, you're on the line with Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin. And what is your question?
I am calling because I'm looking to get a status update on the West Seattle Bridge. I know that from personal experience and as well with other people that live in West Seattle, a lot of individuals are becoming increasingly frustrated with the West Marginal Way detour and the status of the repairs.
Lewis, thanks for the call, and I know that it is enormously frustrating for people, and it will increase as we reopen as a city and people have to start commuting to work and getting more places. The good news is we're on time and on budget, but we won't be reopening the bridge until next year. But we've been, I meet with Seattle Department of Transportation on a regular basis and get weekly updates, and right now we are still on time to get all of that work done on schedule and on budget.
Lewis, is there something you or your neighbors in West Seattle are asking of the city of Seattle while we wait for those repairs?
That's correct. Yeah, there are a lot of us who have just been talking about it. I know that there are a lot of people who are frustrated with how long it's been taking and the prospect of continuing to have to drive around, especially as things open up and as the vaccination rates go up and more people start to leave their homes. So it's just one of those things that we feel a little isolated, but we're, I guess, doing our best as far as that detour goes.
Okay.
Yeah,
yes,
and Lewis, I mean, I've got the T-shirt that has the accidental island. It has been enormously hard on West Seattle, and had we not been in a pandemic, it would be even worse. Unfortunately, there's some things that I can't control as mayor, and the city can't control, and gravity is one of them, and gravity was doing no favors to that bridge. And so we're trying to render it safe and get it reopened as quickly as possible. It was going to be a period of many years had we decided to close it and rebuild it, but we think we can bring it back safely by the repair and reconstruction, and that should happen, be open next year.
Lewis and all the folks of West Seattle, good luck there in the peninsula, so-called. We've got Zane on the line for Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin. Zane, what would you like to know? Thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm wondering if Seattle would ever consider luxury tax for entities or humans that buy homes and choose not to live in them.
Zane, it's a really good question. It's a little bit difficult for the city to do it because state law prohibits us from having a tax on any property that is not the same for every property. But we've been looking at a range of options to make sure we do get at those high-priced luxury sales or people whose second home or even, there's a number of places that remain vacant that were, bought and sold for very high prices. So we're looking at options. We continue to try to see what the city can do by itself and then pushing the state legislature to give cities more power to control it because we have one of the highest, cost of living in America here in the city, and our costs for housing has been increasing more rapidly than almost any city in the country. And every time a really expensive place changes hands, it'd be appropriate for them to have to pay higher taxes, I believe.
Yeah, hasn't Vancouver, BC done something like that, Mayor? We just
they
don't
did
have
do
that
something
option.
Like that. Vancouver was able to do kind of a luxury property excise tax.
Mm-hmm. Okay, pushing on the state, says Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin. Again, our number is 543-KUOW in area code 206, 543-5869. Mayor Durkin, there have been a lot of shootings in Seattle and King County lately. Last year, you appointed a so-called street czar, Andre Taylor, to help calm things between residents and police in the city. Last fall, he said he was hard hit by COVID and was taking a hiatus. Is Taylor still in the job, and are you going to hire someone else?
So not this time, and Andre Taylor were one of a number of people we contracted with last summer to really be alternative to policing and have some credible messengers who could talk to folks. We just have, in the end of last year, beginning of this year, issued some contracts that are some of the most significant we've had in our city's history and are in the process of doing the next round for alternatives to public safety that really emphasize having people who are of and from community be that first front line to try to diffuse some of the conflict that we've seen leading to this gun crime. We're not alone. You know, gun crime is up and shots fired are up in every city in America right now, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or Republican mayor, regardless of which coast it is on. We're seeing an uptick in gun violence everywhere, and it's a number of things have led to it, some of it related to COVID. But a lot of it is post-pandemic, coming out of a pandemic where the economies of communities were really destroyed more rapidly than others. And so we're looking at a range of things to get to how do we diffuse and de-escalate these conflicts before people have guns in their hands.
Could you give us the most important example of what one of those solutions will be?
I was really fortunate about 2 weeks ago. I went to, there was a, what they call the Regional Peacekeepers, which is an affiliation of organizations that are those credible messengers, Choose 180, Community Passageways, and others who were coming together to see how do we do this on a regional basis and how do we actually train people to be these de-escalators. It was really remarkable work. I sat in the room as they were actually being trained, doing role-playing. What do you do if the person says this? What do you do if the person says that? The level of commitment from these individuals was really inspiring. Are formerly incarcerated. They can tell the story of you don't want to end up where I ended up. It can also go and say, look, there's a different alternative. So we're really looking at how do we flip this so that we see by the data that if a person is a witness to a gun crime in King County, they have a much higher chance of becoming a victim of a gun crime. It's a pretty small universe of individuals and groups that are at the center of some of this gun violence. And so if you can get, for example, these peacekeepers to even get to an emergency room or hospital room to talk to the people so that the first impulse isn't how do we get revenge, but it's how do we de-escalate and protect the community. And so it's really getting at that. But at the end of the day, Bill, we've talked about it before. By the time people are in armed conflict, so much else has already gone wrong. And it's one reason I have really been pushing hard to get investments in community to have better pre-K, better childcare, better access to education and free college, getting true economic opportunity, access to affordable housing and health care. Those are the things that will make a community safer.
Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin. Mayor, you're not running for re-election, and you were just featured in a Politico story headlined, America's Mayors Call It Quits. Many city leaders across the nation lacked the will to go on after a year like no other. And you were featured very prominently in that piece. Mayor Durkin, you have dealt with a lot in your term. Pandemic, protests, police reform, a U.S. president directing anger at you, and more. But is all that beyond what any big city mayor should be expected to deal with and withstand, even though it's always unpredictable? What do you say to that?
You know, I think it's really the wrong question, Bill, and I say that with all due respect. I think, one, for me, and we've talked about it before, and I think it was mentioned in the article, that in the cauldron while we were making these very, very difficult decisions over a year's period, to be the first in a global pandemic, to have your economy be eviscerated almost overnight, to have tens of thousands of people out of jobs, to have your seniors have nowhere to go, then have all of, with no playbook, no federal help, having to find your way through those difficult circumstances. And then on top of that, have a civil rights reckoning that really channeled, you know, generations of anxiety. It became very clear to me that I could either run to keep my job or I could do the job I was elected to do. I could not do both. And I really believe that my number one goal was to do the job I was elected to do. So rolling into this year, and very clear at the beginning, is how do we get the pandemic under control? How do we become the first city in America to get vaccinated by 70%? And then how do we reopen and recover in our economy and do it in a way that focuses equity and opportunity? And I'm really proud that we have done that. We have done those things. You know, we were able to have the lowest level of disease, hospitalization, and death of any city in America. We were the first city in America to reach 70% of vaccination rate, and we'll be at 80 within weeks. And now we're reopening our economy, and we're ready to go. So I'm really proud. I think it was the right choice to make, and I'm proud of the efforts that my team and the city has done on this front. This really is government at its best.
Mayor, we have one more minute. What's it like watching so many other people run for the job, and what's your advice to the next mayor?
So the first thing is, I made the right choice for a lot of reasons, but I watch people do things in a vacuum instead of having to make decisions when it matters. And my advice is, don't make a promise that's a bumper sticker. Governing is very complicated. And the more thoughtful you are and the better you can pull people together, the better you'll have a chance of success in the long run. And we saw it last summer, Bill. You know, we were at the height of things where former Chief Best and I, you know, consistently said we did not believe defunding the police by 50% was the right way to go, that we could make significant investments in community, $100 million, and we could reimagine policing. But just a blunt cut, seven of the nine city council members immediately said 50%, and now they've changed direction. And so being thoughtful is really important.
Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, thank you for taking listener questions today, and thanks for being on the record on KUOW, as always.
Bill, it's great to talk to you. Hope you're well.
Doing well, thank you. Same to you, Mayor Durkin. This is The Record on KUOW, Seattle. Bill Radke here with you. And one final note today, you are going to be hearing some changes on KUOW. Well, the Seattle area has changed since we started doing this show, and we need to keep evolving as well. So KUOW is making some big investments in new shows, new podcasts, and we're going to reimagine The Record. So big change on this show, we're hiring a new host. I'm going to switch to a new project. And it's going to focus on you, because some of my favorite times on this show have been talking to you, talking to listeners trying to make sense of the world, as I am. So I'm going to be taking your questions, just get creative with them, use interviews, stories, whatever it takes to satisfy our curiosity about life in the Sound. While I'm working on that, The Record is going to go off the air for the summertime and do a refresh to build a show that can serve you in original ways, help make sense of these unique times that we are living through right now. And we want to hear from you about that. What do you want now from a daily local KUOW show? What topics do you want to hear more about? Who do you want to hear more from? You can talk to us online at kuow.org/record. You can give us your thoughts by email, record@kuow.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. That's 206-221-3663. Again, 221-3663. The Record will take in your ideas and then return after Labor Day. Meanwhile, all summer in the noon hour, You're going to be listening to On Point, a great public radio show hosted by Meghna Chakrabarty. In fact, we're going to have Meghna on our show next week, so you can meet her. So that is Monday through Thursday this summer on the record. Fridays are not changing at all. I'm going to keep hosting Week in Review on Fridays. So that's the plan. Be in touch. Email us or call us with your show ideas, and I'll talk to you tomorrow at noon, as always, on Week in Review. Thanks for listening today. The Record is produced by Jenny Cecil Moore, Alec Cowan, Brandy Fullwood, and Sarah Leibovitz. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow, what does Week in Review mean? You know, that's our roundtable of journalists getting together to help you understand what happened this week and what it all means. You can watch us as we stream that on YouTube and Facebook Live, and you can listen to it in the noon hour here tomorrow, Week in Review on KUOW. And you know, if you can't tune in, that's not a disaster, because you can listen anytime you want, right? You can subscribe to the Week in Review podcast. You can subscribe to the Record podcast. You'll find subscribing links at our website, KUOW.org, or just go to your favorite podcast app and look for KUOW, the Record, and Week in Review. Hey, we'll talk soon.